are in the managing expectations and goal setting with clients who display resistance behaviors training. I'm Danielle Cameron. I'm an LCSW and a community mental health trainer here with UCLA's Public Mental Health Partnership in collaboration with Department of Mental Health. And we're going to get right into the training. So just a little bit, brief bit about my background. So I'm Danielle Cameron. As I said, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I've done a lot of community mental health servicing for a chunk of my career, transitional age youth, who, by way of a transitional housing program, who had formerly been impacted by the foster care system, as well as probation systems. Shout outs to my colleague, former colleague, I won't pull her out to the wolves in front of everyone, but I saw that she joined. So that's super cool to see someone that I once shared a work and community space with here today. So also, as I transitioned out of community mental health, I have been doing a lot of more of the therapy kind of hat and roles by way of individual therapeutic services and group therapy services. And so as you can imagine, just like I would imagine for y'all here today, the nature of working with clients from time to time who present with challenging behaviors and resistant behaviors is nothing that I'm a stranger to. So trick question, but not a trick question. Who's never worked with a resistance or a difficult client before? You can put a thumbs up. You can put in the chat. I know, what would it be? Yes, I have never worked with a client who's resistant or difficult. I'm looking through to see any nods. So, right. That's why I said trick question, but not really a trick question. I imagine that that is also why you all are here, right? So it's the nature of the game. But when, I don't know about for you, when I think about some of the clients that I have serviced and worked with, and when I think about the clients who stand out to me and come to mind as, wow, they might be, we're not supposed to have favorites, but maybe those ended up being my favorite clients, were the clients who initially presented with a lot of resistance, who initially presented with a lot of ambivalence, guards up, and throughout our collaborative and, you know, case management relationship or therapeutic relationship, over time, we were able to help get over that kind of initial presentation of some resistance or, you know, some defensiveness. Like I said, I have a fondness. It's a strange thing how that happens. And I think you all might agree, right, that at times those clients turn out to be some of the highlights of clients that we have worked with. As you see in front of you, this is the formal training kind of description for today. I'm just going to summarize what you can expect for today's training. And we're going to begin with defining and describing challenging behaviors through a discussion. So yes, a discussion. I'm going to take a note here to acknowledge that you all can interact in whatever way is most comfortable. If you want to come off of mute, love to hear it. If you want to enter into the chat, love to see it. However you feel is the most comfortable for you to engage, I invite you to engage in that way. So after we talk about and describe and define challenging behaviors, we're going to examine different models and approaches to really understand and contextualize the function of those behaviors and what those behaviors serve for the client expressing them. Followed by that is the exciting stuff, or I think it's the exciting stuff, which is reviewing some tools and applications to really effectively work alongside resistance behaviors, including setting collaborative goals, Then we're going to wrap up today on reviewing how we as providers can manage the countertransference that comes up, and our overall well-being while supporting ambivalent and change-resistant clients. All right. Some objectives. So what are we going to be, how I should say, are we going to be executing the plan that was just described? We're going to describe how to collaboratively support clients with a person-centered goal-setting process. We're going to identify client-resistant behaviors, such as ambivalence around change and reluctance to engage in services. Through various models. Those models include reviewing the trauma-informed approach, discussing a functional analysis of behavior model, as well as some power dynamics. We're going to also discuss the impacts of burnout, transference, countertransference, and offer some tools to implement self-care. And lastly, but not in any particular order, we're going to utilize the concepts of MI and solution-focused therapy associated with navigating and responding to resistance client behaviors. Pause for a disclaimer on my end. I know enough by way of doing the work, by way of always increasing my capacity of learning and coming by way of new information, but I don't know it all. So please feel free to also share your best practices and tools for working with ambivalent and change-resistant clients, because the name of the game is each one teach one, and I'm just one, and I have a room of many, a virtual room of many. So please, I really encourage and welcome all the idea sharing and interaction today. So as promised, this is the beginning of just some discussion. We won't land here for too long, but curious to hear from you all. How do you define, how do you describe behaviors that you might feel are challenging from clients that you work with or have worked with in the past? So if you were to describe or define challenging behaviors, what does that look like? And I imagine we'll probably have a shared idea and shared kind of sense of around what that looks like. And thanks all for your participation as well in the chat. I'm just going to call out what I see here. Self-sabotaging behaviors, definitely. Why do I have to do this? I don't need therapy, right? Mandated clients, we're going to talk about that. We have refusal to just absolute right refusal for engagement. A fixed mindset, avoidance, being reactive, resistance to treatment overall, inconsistency with change, help seeker, but also help rejectors. Yeah, right. That's a part of that ambivalence. Poor follow through, unmet underlying needs, and unwillingness to meet and engage in services altogether, displayed by a fixed mindset, avoidant, inconsistent with treatment. Amazing. Having a hard time wanting to be there. Yep. Lots of avoidance. I'm seeing come through the chat, withdrawn. And just ultimate refusal. So we have a lot of refusals, lots of avoidance, not participating, not showing up to sessions at all, coming late, not following up with homework, inconsistent. Another common theme is inconsistency I'm seeing. Flat affect, wow, and non-communicative, right. And that can be difficult. I was like, what do we do now? Why are you trying to change me? Wow, that's rich. My parents are forcing me to come. Some more mandated instances, canceling sessions, arriving late, another theme I see. I don't need your services. I'm normal. Not like the others you have to deal with, right? When I think about resistant clients, I think of non-compliant clients or saying what you want. Like to get sober when their actions show they still have reservations about sobriety and stigma behind mental health overall can be a barrier for clients as well. Great examples. Thank you for the engagement. I didn't have nearly as many examples as you all provided, which is why I opened the floor. And so per the screen, really the screen displays everything you all shared and you all added to this. And so we are going to, what's the saying in our field, right? We don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. So within that same vein of philosophy, I'm not going to make any promises that the information I'll share today is going to be the magic wand, right? To being able to miraculously have a turnaround in clients who display the examples of behaviors that you all shared. The aim and the hope is that you'll feel empowered and that you'll feel more confident in just understanding why these behaviors are presenting and having some tools to support the behaviors. But ultimately, right, we know that we cannot, and it is not our goal to change anyone, right? So, another quick check-in, a discussion, and chime in the chat. Do you agree or disagree with the following? So, when we consider how we manage our expectations of our clients' behaviors, do you agree or disagree that ambivalence and resistance are necessary parts of change? Just your opinion. Do you agree or disagree? All right, the people have spoken. So it's a resounding, there's agreement here, which is like I can take a breath because that means that you are genuinely operating and serving your clients from the most, right heart space, most authentic heart space, and most and best mindset as possible. And okay, we have one fence dweller, Portia, not necessary, however normal. I like that. Okay. I am not mad at that response either, although that's not agree or disagree. I'm just kidding. I'll check in again. I don't think I'll need to, but this slide comes up again at the end just to see. It's kind of like a gauge on where we are right now and then maybe how we'll feel later. But it seems like we're kind of norm and on the same page. When we think about resistance and ambivalence as being components of change, I'll just push that little button in terms of the necessity. And if we want to frame it that way and why it could be framed that way, is if we consider the stages of change. You remember that model, pre-contemplation, contemplation, maintenance. So that model, when you consider that model, contemplation, can inherently embody ambivalence, and contemplation, that stage of change, can inherently kind of hold resistance. So it's a matter of semantics, I know, and wording. So not necessary, but it is built in with that idea of the stages of change kind of model in that contemplation phase, that you can anticipate resistance and you can anticipate some ambivalence. You said that you've witnessed some patients get stressed just talking about the possibility of making a change. Right. And that is what we would say, where would they be? What? Pre-contemplation, which makes sense why they would be stressed out just even in that pre-contemplation stage of change, because it's the fear or stress about the unknown around what that could mean, that change could mean. And what they might have to give up in order to make that change. So completely, I think, a normal experience. Thanks for sharing. And so we're gearing into, we defined and described with the help of all of you. So thank you so much. A lot of behaviors that present that can be challenging, that can be displayed as resistance and ambivalent behaviors. And so now we're going to look at some approaches that contextualize these behaviors. And the aim here is really to understand what is the function of the behavior that the client is showing. And By way of doing that, we can help manage our expectations about these behaviors. We can also depersonalize the behaviors that are happening and occurring. And so in the functional analysis model, when you see a client display, I'm just going to scroll up, complete refusal to engage in services, when you see that they're having a hard time wanting to be there, that they are inconsistent, the goal is to ask, okay, what is the function of this behavior? And what is this behavior trying to communicate or do for the client? When we think about resistance, and just generalize, right, the display of resistance, for example, that might be a communication that the client feels completely torn from all senses of power. They feel, especially right with the examples that a couple of folks chimed in, mandated clients, those clients probably especially feel that they have no agency. They especially probably feel that they have lost their right to self-determination. So by way of the functional analysis model, you can really seek to understand a specific target behavior and then seek to identify what are those triggers and what is reinforcing and maintaining that behavior to show up. As displayed too on the visual, when I think about, you know, presentation of behaviors, especially the example that I provided earlier with the client displaying aggressive kind of acts, and I know it was a rich example and I can't remember everything, but what came to mind for me immediately was, I wonder if a part of that is a representation of symptomology of a diagnosis that the client might have, and is that being displayed in the example you provided? So when we think about, you know, the why, or why the behavior is happening, what's the function of it, what is this communicating, we can think about this overlap of a lot of different components at play that offer insight into the display of the resistant behavior, challenging behavior you're seeing. And that's the overlap of some of the symptoms of the client's mental health diagnosis. It can also be triggers, you know, showing up by way of a stress or trauma response. And then, you know, couple that with this overlap of the client's, you know, desire for some control, because there's, you know, that inherent differential in power going on. So really, I think important model to consider when you want to understand, or when you're trying to work with difficult behaviors and understanding how we can manage our expectations of the why these behaviors are showing up. Another model that offers some well, not explanation, but some underpinning to understanding client behaviors is called the brain state model from the conscious discipline approach. And pretty much the conscious discipline brain state model, it's a multidisciplinary approach that, as you can see in the visual here, it's based on three distinct brain body states and both adults and children that drive behavior. So it is what you would call a neurodevelopmental model. And with this model, it focuses on the internal states that are occurring first and then the behavior second. So as you can see within this brain model graph here, you have three different states. There's the executive state, the emotional state, and then at the bottom here, the survival state. So when we consider, I'll give an overview of each of the states. When we consider the survival state, this represents the primal brain. This represents fight or flight. This is, you know, that where that feeling of or not feeling of being safe comes into play. And what the ultimate goal here is, if someone is operating out of what you recognize is their survival state, it could appear as physical, as fighting. It could appear as surrendering, or even hiding, or as I have on the left side of the screen, protecting behaviors, that pushing away, inconsistency, and as you all mentioned, change overall and consistency in showing up to appointments, and overall resistance. Aggressive actions can even happen as an example of operating from survival brain. So when you see through this model, the goal is to be able to recognize on our ends, you know, what the behavior is, and then being able to, as the provider, provider provides, not the most eloquent of words, but as the provider being able to intervene and set, you know, a stage for that client to be held in these various states. So if we notice, for instance, a client in survival, you know, state, then the goal is to create a sense of safety. And that's the only way that you can soothe a client that is in their survival brain. And so you might, you know, do all kinds of self-regulation interventions and activities to really help that client, you know, ultimately feel safe and to turn off that fight or flight and stress response system. The emotional brain, excuse me, is what governs the emotional experiences, survival instincts, and memories, and the need. So when a client is in their emotional brain, their need is really just a sense of connection. That's what they're looking for. The message communicated is, do I feel connected? Am I loved? And the manifestation of that message and that need for connection could look like back talk, could look like yelling, just having that general attitude. I use attitude because I work with young adults, so that's what I got a lot. And just that kind of, you know, talking back type of thing. So when we see that happening, we can understand, okay, my client is looking for possibly connection. So what can I do to offer that sense of connection and sense, you know, of filling that void for that client in our session? And maybe this is an ongoing kind of task as well. When a client is in their executive brain, this is where decision-making is happening, being able to think things through, making good choices. And so when you recognize that they're, you know, in that executive state by way of, you know, they're not resistant, obviously, or displaying resistance at this point, but are really seeking kind of opportunities for continued growth or self discovery and self-awareness, then you can just use that as another function of behavior to recognize, okay, you know, my client is in a space where they are, you know, really gearing towards probably maintenance of change, if we think of the stages of change model. So just another approach to consider, you know, where a client's behaviors might be a function of, as it relates to what brain state is my client in. And just when we consider the brain state, you know, sometimes we have an underlying expectation that our clients are coming to us and that they're operating from their executive state. And when we have that underlying expectation and we think that they're there, that they're ready, that they're working with you because they're ready to learn and to make that change. We're demanding that they're accessing their problem-solving abilities. But what we'll see is that if the client is in their survival or emotional state, right, that's just there's barriers and they're not going to be able to access, the ability to operate in decision making and problem solving and thinking things through and making good choices. If you ever feel frustrated, like, oh my gosh, why does my client keep going to the park after dark where they know they are working or we have a collaborative goal of sobriety and they know that, what's going on around drug usage in that park? They keep making these poor decisions. Maybe it's an opportunity for us to reflect. I might be expecting them to be in their executive brain. They keep making this, decision. Maybe they're in their emotional brain because they're seeking connection. So how can I support that client in that state? I'm looking at the chat. I see a comment. It's more comfortable to do what you know, even when you know it's not a good idea. Great point. Yeah. And when clients put themselves, yeah, in the same, yes, traumatic situations. Absolutely. I also like considering that and working with clients around, managing my expectations of functions of behavior and just recognizing that even though it might be a risky behavior, this behavior has served this client so far, right? They have clearly made it through all of their life, which is why they're sitting in front of me. And although I might have labeled this as a risk, the behaviors as risky, jeopardizing, their livelihood, it's served them. So the goal is to understand, why? What is this? How has this served you? Why has this served you? So I went ahead and support that client in identifying more healthy behaviors. Thank you for bringing that up. Another approach to consider is what I'm sure a lot of you all, if not everyone, is definitely familiar with is a trauma-informed, approach. And so when we, sometimes some of our most challenging clients come from really traumatic backgrounds, might even be diagnosed with some type of PTSD situation. And so when we think about how some of the behaviors that show up can be challenging for us or difficult, like avoiding sessions altogether, being agitated, being aggressive, for instance, in addition to the host of other examples on the slide, these could be reactions by way of a trauma experience. So just wanting to highlight that to keep in mind. That was short-term reactions. Then of course, there's longer-term reactions to trauma that present as well. And I know I'm going to self-disclose when I was working in the field, difficulty concentrating was for me one of the hardest, more difficult pieces in working with a client in a session because I have this ambition, right? And I have these right goals for this client. I want to see them, at their best. And so not being able in session to meet me, right? My foolish expectation, I'm expecting them to meet me where I'm at. And where I'm at is I want you to be able to, keep up with, what we're the psychoed that we're talking about today on anger management and how this is a function of what's going on in your brain sometimes. And the client is like, girl, okay, so where's my food card at? And but like I said, just a piece of self-disclosure, me not recognizing that this is Difficulty concentrating could be a long-term reaction to a traumatic, experience, and could symbolize and indicate that client might have PTSD, and I'm not meeting them where they're at. So in addition to other examples here, I'm not going to review all of those, but these are just hopefully some ways that we can consider when we feel like we're hitting, our heads against the wall. In regards to what we perceive as our clients not making any gains towards, their treatment goals or towards their recovery, we might be able to even kind of tick off what we see happening by way of these examples in our clients and showing up in our clients. So just to, plead for the case of being trauma-informed, which we do have a training on as well, so I encourage y'all to check that out. The involuntary clients, right? The mandated clients. So, what do we do with these clients? How can we help clients who feel that they have completely been stripped away of their choice and their autonomy and their decision, and have no clue about? Will have a clue about maybe why they're sitting in front of you, but don't know what benefit that could serve them because they didn't sign up for this. So first, we want to start with just defining involuntary clients. And involuntary clients are really understood as folks whose involvement with, I have social workers in my notes, but whatever your, hat is mandated by law. That can include families and this child protection system, consumers of mental health services, people with disabilities, older people, such as those with dementia, as well as young folks who fail to attend school, and people in the criminal justice system. So, unfortunately, engagement, right, does not come easily to clients who feel that they have been coerced into treatment. And why are they coming? Because they're going to face either legal consequences if it's court mandated or personal consequences if someone said earlier, if their parents are making them come, right? And oftentimes, what happens is these clients can be categorized as unmotivated or overall resistant. And so, we're not going to separate and differentiate the approaches and tools that we're going to talk about today and working with generally clients who display resistant behaviors from those who have been mandated, for those who are involuntary, because the same kind of umbrella of tools is going to apply across the board. I just wanted to make sure that I made that clear. And I just wanted to emphasize or acknowledge that I know that those are some of the clients that we do end up, having to service. And for the one nugget of maybe differentiation for some of our involuntary clients that you can consider in terms of treatment and supporting those clients is identifying what their primary motivating factors are. So as we just mentioned, right, some of these clients are showing up because they know that they're going to face legal consequences or personal consequences. So when you are developing your treatment goals with these clients, and hopefully it's always with the client, you want to consider and you want to tease and pull out of that client how these motivations can be incorporated into their goals. So when the client, for instance, because I'm sure and I know it happens, you might have the goal of your day or your session with the client to, okay, we're going to create our treatment goals together. You might open the floor and be very clear. I know, you've been mandated by the court for family restoration. I know you want to, or family restoration appears to be, important to you because you're here with me. How can I help you, achieve that? How can we work together to achieve that? And really just try and build that sense of understanding and awareness of what the root of that client's kind of motivation is. Even if they are mandated, they're still, even if it's they don't want to violate parole. Okay, well, how can we do that together? What are some, what are some pieces that you've, always wanted to work on? Maybe as broad as that. We'll go into more specific approaches in a bit, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But just wanting to reiterate that even with an involuntary client or a mandated client, there's still going to be some source of motivating factors for why that client is in front of you. And it's important to really just tease that out and leverage that information into the treatment goals that y'all can collaborate on creating together. I see a comment in the chat says we impose so many adult imperatives and expectations on our youth, absolutely, and often forget the barriers they are up against and their own personal wants and needs outside of mandates. Yeah, so many, layers towards so many layers to consider for the different populations we serve, and considering where, we can identify that client might feel stripped away of their agency and sense of autonomy in having to work with us. An excellent example by way of identifying like how youth might feel, by way of the expectation setting that we might have, for them, that could be unrealistic. And then we can consider, adults as well who maybe are under conservatorship, and what expectations we might, have on that individual, that's unrealistic. Different, like I said, nuances depending on different populations. But I love that because it allows me the opportunity to really drive that point home that a lot of our clients are not just coming to us in very vulnerable states, but a large part of that vulnerability is feeling extremely stripped away of their agency and of their autonomy. And so, when you see that resistance, that is really what you're coming up against, is that client's desire to want to regain that will of control ultimately. So, how can we meet that client where they're at when they're displaying that? For interest of time, I'm not going to show the clip from this YouTube video. It's really, I think, a good find, actually. It's a peer-led training on working and engaging with clients who have been court-ordered and mandated to receive treatment. And as we continue on here and just conceptualizing even what I just mentioned, right, about meeting our clients where they are, mandated or not. But there's gonna, we are seeing a sense of a display of some resistant or ambivalent behaviors. Another way to conceptualize how to increase our engagement successfully with that client is by way of the helping process. I don't know if you all are familiar with the helping process. But really, for today's purposes, we're looking at the first three phases. So overall, the helping process kind of just informs and spells out the phases that as a provider, clinician, therapist, case manager, that we kind of utilize to support our clients in a person-centered approach. And so for today, we're looking at the first three phases, right? Engagement, assessment, and planning. And studies have shown actually that in working with clients with resistance behaviors and looking at the helping process model, that what's going on is that the resistant behavior clients and that rapport with the provider is going to most frequently, excuse me, break down in the beginning during the engagement stage. Okay. And so we're going to discuss, okay, some ways to address that barrier and overcome that breakdown and collapse of that rapport. Because if we can't get the client here at engagement, we're for sure not going to go anywhere else, right? Briefly, when assessment, just meaning that's when you're doing either your formal kind of biopsychosocial assessments, whatever your assessments are, even your scales, your PHQ-9s, suicidality risk scales, all of that stuff. But here is where you're getting the information to help with planning, right? Because planning is the goal setting. So just want to briefly explain those three phases and offer some more context for that's why for today's purposes, you can think about that in terms of the helping process, we're really talking about how do we connect with these clients in these first three phases, since the breakdown is going to happen here at engagement. And as we will discuss later on, some aids for engagement include not just a client-centered approach, but motivational interviewing, and understanding the stages of change model and different approaches to support those stages of change. But of course, since, as was highlighted, that most often than not, clients who display resistance behaviors, the breakdown happens most often than not in that engagement phase, the first phase. Let's talk about engagement a little bit more. And so according to the authors at the bottom, Jacobson and Smith, the four dimensions of engagement include the following: receptivity, or also known or considered as how open the clients are to receiving help in their life, whether or not they recognize there's a problem, whether or not they recognize that there is an actual need for change. The second dimension of engagement includes expectancy. And this is the client's perceptions of, why am I here? Am I gonna, you know, benefit from meeting with you or not? So where's their expectancy? The next dimension is investment. And this is where the client kind of stands on their level of preparedness to have some ownership and take some responsibility for their treatment. I already know that those of you who are thinking about your mandated clients and involuntary clients are like, yeah, how do we get them invested? What is that? When they feel like, you know, they're forced to be here or coerced to be here anyway. Working relationship is the last dimension. And this is that client's attunement, where a client feels seen and pretty much heard by their provider, their therapist. And because of this collaborative and working relationship, you know, there's a fair exchange of open communication between both parties involved. Those are the dimensions of engagement, right? And so when we consider where the challenges come from, they can be understood as resistance, just preferring not to be engaged at all, maybe even displaying some hostility towards change. Mistrust is another challenge to engagement. Goes without saying, right? You can't have that working relationship. The client won't have any type of receptivity if they lack trust in a treatment process, because of various, you know, different factors, even maybe past experiences with other agencies. And then lastly, of course, motivation, which is, it goes hand in hand and without saying, is a key predictor of client engagement. Without, you know, that motivation, you're obviously going to be faced with some challenges to the work that you're supporting the client with. So these examples are how we can just understand that engagement phase from the helping process and right with those goals of engagement include? And then what challenges, which we are already normed on and know because we see it, can come to fulfilling that engagement phase. So what do we do? How do we support those challenges to engagement? So in the next few slides, I have some tips and some pointers on effective practices with clients who display resistance. And this is for those of you who are in desiring to seek more information on your voluntary and mandated clients. I think you'll be happy to know that this article that I used to reference these principles was actually specifically tailored for working with involuntary clients. So I hope that that's maybe some hopeful news for those of you wanting that specific information. But of course, these practices apply across the board to any type of client displaying resistance. Okay. And so the first principles, role clarification. And once again, just consider the helping process and, you know, an engagement that these tips are definitely some applications and some approaches that we would want to engage our clients with in that first phase. So we want to start with clarifying our roles and helping our clients understand the role of us as the worker or the provider and the role of the client. You can do this by just laying it and spelling it out plainly and clearly, you know, the authority that might be involved. I'll just explain that in a second, and how it might be used in the goals of the treatment from both your perspective and then hearing from the client's perspective. Once again, this article is really tailored towards those working with involuntary and mandated clients. So when you discuss that authority, it's laying out and spelling out very plainly, acknowledging, I should say, really the elephant in the room. There's a power dynamic here, right? You didn't choose to be here, right? So let's talk about that. What are your feelings around that? What do you expect from me? Okay, this is what I expect from you. My goal is to help you remain compliant to the court mandates or whatever it is. And this is how I play a role in that. How do you play a role in that? And then there are some other points for discussion at the bottom, of course, explaining the purpose overall of treatment. I really want to highlight your authority and how it can be used. So being very transparent and upfront with the client, you know, around if it is a part of your role to provide follow-up notes or progress notes to the clients. I guess it would be maybe the judge or lawyer. Forgive me, I haven't done that in a while. But if any of that is needed, then you want to make sure that you are not catching your client off guard, that they know I'm going to have to, you know, however often the frequency is, provide, you know, how you're doing, what your progress is looking like, and know that that can maybe harm your outcome or not, depending on, you know, the way that we collaborate and work together. But my goal is to really, you know, ultimately help you achieve, you know, restoration with your family, if it's CPS or, you know, whatever the case, for instance. Also want to talk about, well, I'll keep going for sake of time. The next effective practice, as noted through this article, is problem solving. And this is collaborative problem solving. We also do a training on problem solving therapy, if you want to check that out as well. That's a one that I facilitate, really, really great training. A lot of the strategies that are actually listed here are from that problem solving therapeutic model. And so But in the spirit of problem-solving therapy, it's all about client-centered and collaborative-centered. And you really are working with helping the client identify what is your definition of the problem that we're helping to work through. How do you define the issue? How do you understand what the, or what is your understanding of the problem? And then from there, with the client, you develop goals, which we'll get into later, of course, and different strategies to help the client achieve those goals. So when we think about our helping process, we're going into assessment kind of land right now and identifying, okay, we're assessing what's the problem, what's the issue, but really empowering the client to let you tell it from their, let them tell it from their lens. And these are just different ways by way of the problem solving therapy to achieve that. You can do a problem survey, problem ranking. And then after you explore the issues, you want to develop the goals and just ongoing monitoring. All that is goal setting stuff, which we'll talk about in a bit. The next principle is the relationship. And so, in using all of the relationship skills that I know inherently a lot of us have, which is why we do the work we do, for a refresher, you know, some of that, for example, is being optimistic, reflective listening, showing up authentically, showing up in a genuine way to ultimately provide that client with a sense of safety, to further provide the client with a sense of trust, especially considering what our clients have come from in terms of experiences with different providers, with different legal systems, and all of that. You know, trust is what I have seen, as I'm sure many of you have seen, is a large, large piece of the work is building the trust because they have had it burned. So, but here are some of the ways to enhance these relationship skills. And you might want to use appropriate humor from time to time. If that's genuine for you, I say go for it. If you know you feel comfortable in challenging rationalizations that you see the client demonstrating, go for it. And that means when a client is showing justifying behaviors or justifying an attitude, that might be a negative attitude with logical reasons. That can be the rationalization that can show up. And, you know, it's not helpful for the client in terms of reaching peaks of self-awareness. So if you feel comfortable and you have that skill of being assertive, then challenge those rationalizations. And if you feel within yourself, you're in a space too, where you're comfortable to use appropriate self-disclosure. A lot of studies have found therapeutic benefits to that. Go for it. Just certain examples, as I said. I'm going to play a couple of minutes of this YouTube video, which just really is an accumulation and summary of different ideas for working with clients who display resistance from different therapists and clinicians. I think it's such a great, great kind of tool to have and reference. So I just want to give y'all a little teaser. Forgive me for the sample and for it being a tease. And as promised, I'm going to include this link as well in the chat a little later. But we'll play a couple minutes.
I think of resistance as exactly what needs to happen. If you're seeing it right in front of you, it's not a problem to be solved. It's a signpost towards an issue. The reason people are resistant is there's work to do. And you wouldn't blame a client because they have work to do. If people are showing that kind of resistance, it's because it's hard. That's why they're coming to see you. So rejoice in the resistance, in the sense of you have a guide towards something that's hard to turn towards. And get a little less mindy, get a little more experiential.
How do we work with a client who's resistant? Resistance is a very common problem in the therapeutic relationship, and it's one of the main issues that can end treatment prematurely. So how do we get to the root of our client's resistance? How can we help them embrace change, even though it's painful? I asked Bessel van der Kolk, Sue Johnson, Zindel Siegel, and Dick Schwartz what they thought about this issue, and I'd like to share it with you now. I'm hoping you'll be able to use at least one of these ideas in your work today. So to begin, I spoke with Sue Johnson, the creator of Emotionally Focused Therapy. We talked about the core issue of resistance and how resistance can also refer to our own frustration when a client isn't following our plan.
What do you do when somebody isn't where you want them to be? You back the hell up and go join them where they are. That's what you do. But you have to back up and you have to join the resistance. The person is saying, I can't take one step forward here. This is too much. And I always assume it's about threat. It's about being afraid. So I go in as a good surrogate attachment figure and calm the person down. I reflect, I talk about it, and I say, and I slice the risk thinner. If I'm going to work with it, I say, could you turn and tell her, please? I can talk to Sue about these things, but it's just too hard for me right now to turn and share them with you. It's too hard.
Yeah, I have to switch slides. Sorry, like I said, so sorry. It's just a tease. I'll provide the link a little bit later, but I hope you all have the opportunity to check out what they were sharing in terms of just different mindsets to even have, or mind shifts to even have, in approaching resistance as it comes up. So we're going to switch gears now and discuss the goal setting phase. So this is a part, when we think back to the helping process, this is planning. So how are we supporting clients who display resistance with goal setting? When we consider goal setting and why it is encouraged and emphasized to set collaborative goals, partnership with your client, it's because it improves client engagement. There are studies that, show this all over the place. Pretty much the why is that as clients progress toward their goals, this idea or notion of a positive feedback loop is set into motion, and that inspires and informs motivation and continuation on client working on their recovery or treatment goals and things. And so alongside, trust, building rapport, being person-centered and collaborative with our clients, we talked about autonomy and self-determination. And so before we even go forward into goal-setting strategies, I really thought it was important to mention the utilization of empowering our clients and the utilization of really supporting our clients fostering a sense of autonomy and agency. And that is by way of this theory. So not only, at least for my learning, is self-determination or the client's right to self-determination an ethical principle of social work, but there's a whole theory, who knew, that supports pretty much the efficacy of self-determination. And when we think about, what's this importance looks like, it really serves that realm of supporting the client with their motivation. They come in, maybe they don't have any motivation for change. They just know they were told to be there, mandated to be there, or it's just a part of the programming that they are getting services for to participate in treatment. And you know, they feel that, okay, I guess I'm here because there's a change that I should make, or need to make. And so through the self-determination theory, it really supports the importance, and by studies and data, has demonstrated that when we support our clients with that intrinsic kind of development of intrinsic motivation, and when we support them by way of empowering them to really see how many strengths they have in accessing and displaying their own autonomy and their own agency in their treatment, there's improved outcomes in those treatment goals. Go figure, but not really. It all makes sense, right? So one of the supportive approaches to empowering our clients and increasing their sense of agency is by way of motivational interviewing, and we'll talk about that in a bit. So in addition to motivational interviewing skills, such as OARS and rolling with resistance, a couple other strategies that will be added to your toolkits today, probably not new to anyone, but the SMART goals approach. We'll go through that kind of step by step in terms of building engagement specifically with that lens with clients. And then also from the solution-focused therapy approach, we're going to talk or just give some, excuse me, it's solution-focused. It is therapy, I'm sorry. We're going to use a couple of slides to just go through some examples of solution-focused interviewing and key questions to use to help clients who might come to you with, I don't have a goal, and how we can kind of elicit that some type of motivating factor and create some goals from our clients. All right, and so going to our toolkit and pulling out one of our strategies here, we're going to start with solution-focused interviewing questions. This is from the solution-focused approach. And so, how can we help our clients with shaping goals by way of solution-focused interviewing? Overall, this approach, or the goal, I should say, the approach is to really support individuals' resiliency and sense of ability to make positive changes in their life by utilizing their strengths and skills. So when we think about, you know, our goal in supporting autonomy and agency, we can use these set of open-ended questions, and allowing our clients by way of these questions, excuse me, to be the expert of their own lives. So here are some examples of some questions that you might, you know, ask, especially in the face of a situation where a client, you're like, okay, what are we here to do? How can I help you? I don't know. I don't think you can help me. You might want to ask, you know, how would someone else know that what we're doing together, that our treatment plan is working? Or what are your hopes? And what difference would it make if you were able to see your hopes manifest in your life? You can ask what's not listed here. What is your need? And what steps can we take to get to that need? Or even, which I love this question, what would you like to see instead of the problem? Especially for our mandated clients, I just think about how, you know, hit over the head they probably have been with, you know, feeling like they are the problem, whatever has gone on that has led them to being mandated, you know, that problem behavior that probably is the center of their life, and contributes to some of that resistance. And so I think that's a beautiful question to ask in those situations. What would you like to see instead of that problem? Okay, so that's one strategy in the toolkit. The other strategy in our toolbox when we consider collaborative goal setting with our clients is SMART goals. And so I'm going to give you guys a disclaimer. We are not going to get to everything today, but you have the content and the engagement has been, I think, really impactful. And I'm going to do my best without talking in fast forward mode because that's not helpful to get through as much as we can. Going back here, and I'm having to switch my brain. So we're talking about SMART goals, which I'm not gonna spend so much time. The information is here. Just know that, like I said, I'm sure everyone is familiar with SMART goals and that acronym: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time specific. And the following approach is really tailored specifically towards helping clients collaboratively set these goals from that SMART goal approach, who are in treatment or who are in recovery. Just as mentioned, right, having just a perfect kind of way to bring this all together, having all of these kind of competing priorities and areas of need happening at once, and that sense of overwhelm. And knowing, yes, I know that I need support in these issues, but this is a lot and I have to keep up with a lot. We want to be mindful of that. And we want to ensure that when we're working with our clients on the goal setting, that we're starting slow and that we are starting small, and that we're not going right into, the whole Maslow's hierarchy of needs at once. Like, let's just, it's already daunting for the client to be sitting in front of you in the first place. And if the goals are too big and if it's too overwhelming, you are risking losing your client's engagement, right? So really just be mindful and intentional about that as you're working with your clients around goal setting. As I mentioned in that acronym of SMART, you want to be, help your client to articulate specific goals, goals that are measurable. And I highlighted this example from measurable, by, just knowing that it's a collaborative effort. By way of the language used here, I love it. How will we both know when this goal has been achieved? That really just makes a world of a difference, just even as small as language we're using to foster that sense of partnership and that working relationship that we want with our client, because we want them to feel like they have that. Someone said it, right? Physical support as well as verbal support, but all of that. We want them to feel all the support, okay? We go into attainable and achievable goals. We want, of course, these goals to be set in a way that it is easy for our clients to see that, hey, I can work towards checking this goal off. And sometimes that may take some reframing of a goal in order to make it more bite-sized and less kind of big and vague. So I don't have a more illustrative example right now. But as we, help clients with attainable goal setting, making sure they're achievable, then want to make sure that they are relevant or realistic, and that the goals are, if I could highlight this, I would, but personally meaningful to the client. I'm not sure some of you all work in spaces where you are kind of upheld to providing certain treatment services. So therefore, like maybe your goals are prescribed to you and what you have to work on with the client. And if that is the case, Just maybe consider some creative approaches to also ensuring that the client feels connected to maybe those goals by going a little off script and eliciting from the client, what meaningful needs they would like addressed or and what meaningful goals they would like to see achieved. These are some examples on how to achieve getting goals to being relevant or realistic. Check that out when you have time. And then the T, we want them to be, of course, time specific. And we want to set deadlines because we have to track and measure. And I know that you probably, for your own spaces and places of work, have to achieve things with your client by certain times. Lastly, there is, according to this article, an S that's added here to SMART that's not shown, but that S is support. And we can't emphasize enough, right? Just the power of supporting our clients all together and improving their chances of achieving their goals, improving their, commitment to a goal, and improving their sense of connectedness and belonging. So, gonna keep going here. Through motivational interviewing, there are a couple of approaches that I teased out of that model to really help with setting goals collaboratively with resistant clients. And so we already discussed a little bit and know that MI is really helpful for client empowerment, for increasing that self-determination and autonomy for our clients. And it's also a really great tool to support ambivalence and just help clients increase motivation for goal achievement. And so, starting with ORS, O-A-R-S, this approach really supports ambivalence. And you do that by way of starting with open-ended questions. If you get stuck on some open-ended questions, you can pull from that solution-focused interviewing slide for some examples. Also with ORS, the A is affirmation. So validating the efforts that you see your clients demonstrating and just acknowledging, what positive behaviors and efforts the client is making using reflective statements and summarizing. So when we think about how this supports with clients' autonomy and a sense of self-determination, we consider that ORS recognizes ambivalence, or MI, excuse me, recognizes ambivalence as not seen as a weakness. It's not seen as a lack of willingness to change, but consider it a part of the change process. And so we can use that as a reminder for our own mind shift and mindset, but I encourage you to also share that with your clients too. That, what was it, radical honesty that someone brought up, but utilizing in those relationship skills, radical honesty, when you feel like you had that type of rapport with your client and just letting them know, I see that, and by way of reflective statements too, I see that, you have a desire to want to decrease, how much you let's say smoke. That was a lot of the clients I had. So you want to like stop smoking as much, but I also am seeing that when I come to site, you are smoking in the parking lot just about every day I come to site. I'm just wondering, how do you see, where you stand in that situation? Do you, and how can I help you? with that. So by way, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought too, but by way of that example and calling out ambivalence, letting that client know, like, as an opportunity that, although there's this discrepancy in what you've articulated to me as a goal you want to work on, and when I see your behaviors and actions displaying, we this is called ambivalence, and you can think about it as it's completely normal and this is completely natural, and I'm going to work with you and alongside you to help you ride that ambivalence and to help you achieve that goal. But that means we're, on the right track of your change process. I'm so sorry I went on a roller coaster to utilize that example to explain just providing our clients with psychoed. There's a case example here. Okay, we have enough time. We won't land here for too long, but definitely want to allow some time for just practicing and tool application in our training today. So I'll read, forgive me if it's a little small. I'll read the case example and then let me go ahead for you all. I want you to consider how you would utilize the ORS approach with this case example. So remember, open-ended questions. What might those look like that you would want to ask? What type of affirmations would you provide? How would you re demonstrate reflective listening? And what thoughts come to mind in terms of summarizing what's going on here? So here's our case example. Joe is a 34-year-old man who has just returned to staying on Skid Row. He is diagnosed with schizophrenia and has experienced significant trauma throughout his entire life. He recently fled his transitional housing program that he has been in for 6 months because he was worried his neighbor might call the cops on him for his frequent substance use. Joe isn't sure he wants to return to his housing anyway, as he didn't like living with neighbors who were always spying on him and complaining about him making noise and cigarette smoke all night. His roommate was trying to stop using all drugs, and Joe felt guilty for bothering him. Joe wasn't sure how to cope with that feeling on top of his other fears. It led him to drinking, smoking, and using meth more. Joe often used drugs outside of the building because he didn't want to be a bother to his roommates, even though he hated the stares he would get from his neighbors. Although Joe has shared with his case manager, Yesenia, that he really wants a stable life, he shares that he feels less guilt and shame for his substance usage by staying on Skid Row, and he is unsure how Yesenia can really help him. Okay, so in the chat, if you were considering how to meet Joe where he is based on what is provided, utilizing the ORS approach. So we have a situation where there's obvious ambivalence, on Joe's end, in terms of remaining unhoused. And being able to live shame-free in that manner, or returning back to his housing program. I would start with thanking Joe for being so transparent and honest with me about what he's going through. Sounds like an affirmation to me. Thank you. Contributed. Wow, that was very thoughtful of you to consider your roommate's needs when you made that decision. I'm curious though, how has this decision impacted your life? Lovely. Sounds like reflective listening, affirmation and reflective listening. Beautiful example. Thank you. Let me see. Da, da, da. Affirming that he has been considerate to his roommate. Yeah, in his recovery. Absolutely. You would start with reflective listening, normalizing and empathy and compassion to meet him where he is and wait for a response. Wonderful. We have some open-ended question examples. Amazing. Thank you. How are you right now? How do you feel? What are your fears? Can you further explain? Can you tell me more about the guilt and shame you're experiencing? What does it look like to have experienced that guilt and shame before? Wonderful. Point out his ambivalence, wants a stable life, right? Call the ambivalence out. Yeah, bring it to his attention so you can see how you might help him overcome that. And then being empathetic and affirming him. Yeah, building trust with Joe and showing non-judgment and empathy. That sounds stressful for you. I can understand why you feel like returning to Skid Row. Yeah, but how would returning to Skid Row serve you? Ooh, I love that. It's a really great example. Joe would be lucky to have any of you all. Thank you for all of that engagement. I think all of your ideas are spot on. For your reference, here are just some other considerations connected to this particular vignette on how you might want to implement the ORS framework, but really, really lovely examples. And so the other strategy of MI is rolling with resistance. If you want a refresher, you're unfamiliar with the term rolling with resistance, it's really when a provider is working to elicit the client's own motivations for change. And it's a combination of basic clinical skills, such as what we've talked about under ORS, affirmations, open-ended questions, summarizing, reflective listening, and the overall spirit of MI, which is understood as respecting client autonomy, supporting choice, and acknowledging ambivalence. So, rolling with resistance, I like to think about is really the product of the ORS framework and the spirit of MI. And when you blend those two skillfully, then you have the dance of navigating resistance, basically. And so, really, in general, motivational interviewing strategies for navigating resistance ultimately do reflect this sense of a spirit or an attitude of dancing rather than wrestling with resistance, which involves a mindset shift. So that's ultimately what rolling with resistance, I like to think of it, empowers ourselves as the providers to do. It really allows us to just shift our mindsets and understand, the resistance and validate the resistance as valuable information. And the principles also show on the left that you can acknowledge resistance as well as a stop. So this is a place where I should stop and recognize that maybe there's a repair in my working relationship with this client that's needed. And lastly, for principals, it also, is an opportunity to encourage open expression of concerns, and you would utilize empathy by way of doing that, and using it as a point to shift the conversation or the dialogue. Or the lack of, because there's some resistance happening, to back to the client and back to, encouraging the client, one, validating you're there for them, affirming you're there for them, and even making clear your desire to want a collaborative relationship with this client. And so how, and how can we facilitate that together? Are there any concerns that you have? Because I'm noticing, there's some guard that you have right now as we talk about returning back to the housing program, in the case of the vignette with Joe. So it's just another tool, as I mentioned, and do want to really emphasize. All of these tools are approaches that you can really use however you see fit, right? This is really tailored towards just providing a lot of different routes and ways in terms of this segment here of how to actually collaborate with our clients and tools and applications we might want to use, especially around goal setting and in instances where clients are ambivalent about goals or when they just have a flat resistance to wanting to establish any goals, that these are just some examples of ways to kind of flow around those barriers. Okay. We're not going to do this vignette. I encourage you to check it out in the handout. But this is just an opportunity to really think through and reflect on how you would navigate a situation with a client who is displaying a complete resistance to goal setting and has no kind of ambition to setting any goals with you. So definitely a great exercise to check out when you have time. And I'm sorry that we don't have time to do it in our training today. We are now shifting more into what we as providers can do to kind of safeguard what might come up for us in working with clients that present with challenging behaviors, okay? Because I had a discussion slide for that, but I'm sure that on your end, you know, at least for myself, it can be really defeating to work with clients who are just openly resistant to any of the approaches you're trying. It can be frustrating, right? There might even be, you know, dread that might come up when you are working with these clients. And so we just want to normalize in this upcoming section just the impacts of working with resistant or ambivalent clients. So it's important, of course, to maintain boundaries, not just personal boundary setting, but having professional boundaries. You are definitely tasked with, you know, engaging that within your places of work, but especially with your clients, and especially with clients who display maybe some challenging behaviors, right? Just because a client is having a bad day, it doesn't give them the right to throw things at you. It doesn't give them the right to yell at you or, you know, to cuss you out. You still can assertively have boundary setting, right? And it's very important, especially with clients who display resistant behaviors, to have and maintain boundaries, because there is kind of right this need to maybe want to have some boundary crossings just to get that client to maybe complete what they need to complete for the session, or maybe just to get them out your office. You might be, it might be easier and more accessible to allow a boundary crossing, but it's not helpful overall to the working relationship with that client. Before, of course, you can even consider, you know, setting boundaries, maintenance of boundaries. We want to do it also with a mindset of displaying unconditional positive regard at all times with our clients. And it just means that even in the face of very self-defeating, aggressive, resistant behaviors, that we remain non-judgmental at all times. And that it is really important to the position of power that we have in that working relationship and alliance with our clients, that we remain unconditionally non-judgmental, right? You can imagine the damage that could come when a client might perceive any sense of judgment on your end, even in displays of what might be challenging, and especially in displays of what could be challenging behaviors for us. Not going to go into the ins and outs, but this is just a way to conceptualize defining boundaries and how important it is to maintain boundaries, especially when dealing with resistant, negative, and difficult behaviors. Once again, boundaries are super important for both our safety and the client's safety to exemplify quality care. And then ultimately, boundaries are an ethical practice and principle as well. I encourage you all to visit and check out this slide in your time, or hopefully you have some free time to go through the deck. But I want you to even consider, you know, the experience of saying no, and how that feels, and how can, you know, you manage those feelings that might come up when you have to assertively articulate a boundary with a client, and, you know, what that might look like in the face of pushback from that client. So really the experience of saying no, as it says, can be really, for some of us, especially we're showing up with empathy. So it's natural that we'll probably have some very, you know, strong feelings that come up within ourselves around how that, you know, setting a boundary could, we perceive it could impact our clients, right? But it's ours to manage and to contain. Speaking of managing shame or managing and containment, these are some examples of how, in the face of some pushback from a client or maybe some perceived shame experienced by the client for putting a boundary, you can manage that. As well as a slide that I really appreciate, so thorough. Regarding the types of communication and recognizing what those types of communications look like by way of actions, body language, emotions, and what the goal is of the different types, the passive aggressive, and assertive approaches of communication. So really great chart, and just ultimately this is where we want to live, right? In the assertive column when we're articulating a boundary with the client. And here are some steps that you can implement to really effectively have assertive communication with your clients. And of course, we all will have emotional reactions to our clients, as we discussed. I'm sorry we don't have time for a little discussion around that end. But just wanted to note, you know, and normalize, as I mentioned earlier, the impacts that working with clients who display challenging behaviors can have on us. And it can really, over time, accumulate into chronic work-related stress, and that can lead to your turnover and the burnout. And so when you consider self-care, think about, you know, self-care as a responsibility to yourself and to your clients, to keeping you in that flow state of being able to show up, being able to continuously work to help others. So self-care is not a selfish act. If you don't put on your oxygen masks, like, you know, on the flights first, you cannot save anyone else, right? We won't go over this too much, but just want to provide some symptoms of burnout and what that, you know, can manifest as. Of course, being mindful, especially when working with clients who are challenging and present resistant behaviors, or the countertransference that can happen, and knowing when that is happening, those feelings, emotions, even behaviors showing up for you, making sure that you get supervision and that you're able to speak with some trusted colleagues or even your supervisor about that. And then here are some clues. Countertransference can have positive aspects as well. So very interesting dynamics to consider. Okay, defining self-care. Here's a self-care plan that you can, or a template of a plan you might want to use to put together your own, what word am I trying to say? Your own proactive instead of reactive self-care plan. And just another slide just about countertransference and what do you, you know, by utilizing a trauma-informed lens, how can you maintain your own experiences around maybe trauma or maybe a client's traumatic experience is, you feel very much related to yours. What comes up for you in those instances, and what self-reflective practices can you use? And just thinking about what are your own risk and resiliency factors as well. So the same things we preach to our clients, right? All right, y'all, that is the end. All right. So thank you all again for your time and especially for your engagement and participation. It just really helps with, like I said, fostering this shared, you know, learning space. And I think that you all are experts in your own rights of your own tools and applications and interventions. So thank you for your sharing and participating for the benefit of everyone else as well. That slide is back. So just remember, right, ambivalence and resistance. It's a, we can consider these components as necessary parts of change. And I hope you all have a great day.